So here we are reading Richard II. Those of you, how many of you have already read Richard II? Well, four of you in this five. Have you not?
It's our next text.
It's your next text, so you have to?
I've read half of it so far.
Half of it so far. Okay. What's your text due?
Monday.
Oh, okay. So you guys really are in the I don't really care. So if I allude to direct things about the text, you're just going to look at me and nod knowingly. Is that true?
Yes.
Good. Okay. Renee is the only one I probably know that has actually read it because she's had the class already. But that was years ago. She probably doesn't remember much of it. So Richard was a bad guy. Okay. So let's talk about what these plays are about. These are Richard II is the start of the history plays. And the history plays are this arc of Shakespearean plays that start with Richard II and end up for us in Henry V. And Richard is sort of, if you love, right, Henry V. How many of you have seen Henry V? How many have seen the Branagh version? Quite a few of you, right? He's awesome. He's a great actor. He brings Henry V to life. And you're thinking, great, the history plays, man, they must be all like Henry V. No, they're not. Sorry to disappoint you. They are radically different, but they are radically different with an intention. One of the things that the history plays do is allow you to live vicariously in situations that, of course, you will never have to. None of you, I don't think, will be King of England anytime soon. Queen of England anytime soon.
Those princes aren't married yet.
Okay. So some of you have designs on... But you wouldn't be a princess, right? You would be like the duchess or something, because you're not born into royal blood. Is that good enough for you? Okay, good. Okay. we're glad to know that you will settle. That's really important. What they, though, enable us to do is they sort of blow up these experiences into larger-than-life things that you can then examine. So while you will never be vying for your throne from a usurper, there will be times in your life when you will be persecuted, prosecuted, have to argue for yourself, have to make decisions about the nature of something political. And these Shakespearean plays enable you to grapple with the complexities of political life, of the way in which you make decisions, of what really is going on in some people in light of their internal states of affairs. So there will be these things like soliloquies where they will tell you what they're thinking so that you know what goes on in the mind of the king, or of the traitor, of the usurper. And Richard's really interesting because nothing's very clear from the outset. You start with Richard on the throne, and by the way, when he gained the throne, he was 10 years old. And so there was a regent put in place. He was overlooked by a court, and the kingdom was run without Richard during the early years of his reign. Now, if you look at the little chart that I gave you, you have Edward III on the top. And it's interesting because Edward III is interesting in the sense of during the medieval times, most people's children died very young. But for some reason, Edward's children actually lived quite a long time, which causes part of the crisis, right? What happens is there's only one throne. And there are How many here? One, two, three, four. Four people vying for it. And they're all being cagey. They're all wanting a piece of the throne, but nobody's going to make overt, at least early on, maneuvers for the throne. But eventually what happens is people aren't very happy with the reign of Richard for various reasons. Some say, and most of this is, I should say, the history here, how would you say it, is given to lots of poetic, theatrical license. So yes, there's a Richard II. Yes, all of the main players are real. And after that, it depends on the whim of Shakespeare as to whether or not it is historically authentic and accurate. So what happens is there are people who try to usurp the throne in various ways through maneuvers in Parliament. I'm not going to get you involved in all the boring details. If you really want to know, there's a really good book called Shakespeare's English Kings that sort of goes through all the complexities of these attempts to usurp the throne, who gets to usurp the throne, what's wrong with usurping the throne, what's the historical events, has anyone ever tried to do it before, who has, what's been successful, etc., etc., etc. And it's a lot of, and then so-and-so who is married to so-and-so is married to thus and such, who's the nephew of someone, who's the cousin on the third side, who is related to the King of France. That person had the closest right to the throne because of, and then you're like somewhere your eyes roll back in your head and you find yourself napping, okay? But the reason that this is important because, and it is important to a certain extent, is because if you're trying to figure out who's next in line, this becomes a serious issue, right? Even when you're little, nobody likes people that cut in line. And there are rules about cutting in line. And so what happens is there are much more, because, you know, you're dealing with royalty, you're dealing with the regency, there are rules about cutting in line. And people are busy trying to figure out how they can usurp the rules. Because you remember you have special rules that if you leave the line when you were little, remember, and someone could hold the place for you, but only if certain things were said or done, and then of course you had to get the agreement of other people that were in the line that would be okay. Right? And so the complexities of all of this was drawn out to the nth degree. Well, this, your young life, even your adult life, has nothing on the sort of machinations that go on inside of the British royal family. And so what happens is there is much intrigue. People try to overthrow each other. The most loyal follower of Richard is John of Gaunt, whose son is Henry Bolingbroke. And John of Gaunt stays loyal the whole time of Richard's reign until he actually retires from public service. But he's the only one. Everyone else is vying for the throne in one way or another. And Richard is continually trying to consolidate his power. And England is a messy place at the time. England is dealing with, to the north of them, the Scottish people who don't like to listen to anyone, who are stubborn, who at a whim will paint themselves blue and come and attack everybody just because they can. There are the Irish, who will never agree to anything and will rub themselves with potatoes and attack. No, but they will, right? They have... So trying to consolidate the power of England at this time is complicated, and that's saying it nicely. Not only that, you also have to control all of the dukes, all the earls, all the aristocracy that supposedly works for you. Because at a whim again, they will have an uprising. And so think about this. You're supposed to be king. You're supposed to be all powerful. You get into the throne, and all of a sudden somebody tells you, by the way, you're not all powerful. By the way, people will revolt if you do something that makes them angry. Don't forget to watch the church because they're tricky too. I mean, everybody's in on this and everybody's playing this really complicated game. And when you, for us, when we read something like Richard II, it's not very clear to all of us, right? We haven't lived sort of our lives in thinking about what the regent looks like, thinking about how the king or queen has come to power. We don't live and breathe that kind of stuff. So we see the start of the play, and the start of the play has to do with a murder. So Shakespeare actually opens up right away with this issue of murder. And the person murdered is the Duke of Gloucester. Duke of Gloucester. Wow, the Gook of Gluke? Wow, the Duke of Gloucester. And Bolingbroke, the son of John of Gaunt, is mad. Because Thomas Mowbray, who was supposed to be watching the Duke of Gloucester, who had been imprisoned for an attempted rebellion, but had not been tried, not been convicted yet, was on his way to the bathroom when he accidentally slipped on a banana peel and then fell down the stairs. And magically, he got back up and fell down the stairs again. Then he got back up and he fell down the stairs again. Then he got back up and he fell down the stairs again. And then, oh no, he was dead. It was so tragic. We don't know how it happened. I mean, so literally, there is this... We know that he died in the charge of Mowbray. And it looks like an inside job. But it looks more than just like an inside job. It looks like Richard's fingerprints are all over it. So Shakespeare, right from the beginning, drops us in the middle of intrigue. Drops in the middle of this, of the court being in an interesting kind of chaos. And one of the things you want to do when you start reading a Shakespearean play, especially these history plays, is you want to notice that the way the court is not just about that place in relation to where it's at in London, but it actually is a way in which you can measure the temperature of England itself. What kind of place is England if the leadership, supposedly ordained by God, are busy killing each other off to try to consolidate their own power? What's really interesting, though, is both Bolingbroke and Mowbray aren't really friends of the king. The king doesn't trust them. So it's interesting that the murder of Gloucester by Mowbray may be a way in which he tries to get back in the king's good graces. And Bolingbroke, who really doesn't have, it's not clear that he has really any attachment to his uncle, seems to be very upset about his death. And so I want to read you a section of Bolingbroke's speech, which is in the first act, first scene. And we start with Richard II on the throne. And here's what happens. Bolingbroke comes in and says, "First heaven be the record to my speech, in the devotion of a subject's love, tender the precious safety of my prince, and free from my other misbegotten hate. Come, my appellant, to the princely presence. Now, Thomas Brabe, do I turn to thee." So he says hello to the king, and he turns, and he says what? "Do I turn to thee, and mark my greeting well. For when I speak, my body shall make good upon this earth, or my divine soul answer it in heaven. Thou art a traitor and a miscreant, too good to be so, and too bad to live. Since the more fair and crystal is the sky, the uglier, wow, can't talk today, the uglier seems the clouds that in it fly. Once more, the more to aggravate the note, with a foul traitor's name stuff I thy throat. And wish, so please, my sovereign, ere I move, what my tongue speaks, my right-drawn sword may prove. So right there, in the court, he's calling him out. So Mowbray replies and says this: let not my cold words here accuse my zeal. 'Tis not the trial of a woman's war, the bitter clamor of two eager tongues can arbitrate this cause betwixt us twain. The blood is hot that must be cooled for this. Yet can I not such tame presence boast, and to be hushed and not at all to say. And then he goes on and says, draw near and list with what our counsel we have done. For our kingdom's earth should not be soiled with that dear blood which it has fostered. And for our eyes do hate the dire aspect of civil wounds plowed up with a neighbor's sword. And he goes on, he says, your cousin Hereford, upon pain of life, till twice 5 summers hath enriched our field, shall not regret our fair dominions, but tread the stranger's path of banishment. Oh, whoa, I read the wrong one. It was out of order. I'm sorry. I'm thinking, that doesn't sound right. And that's why it doesn't sound right. I actually read his response. Okay. But I have the book here. Okay. Sorry about that. All right. Ah, here we go. This is even better. I thought, that sounds wrong. But I'm thinking, it's just Shakespeare. Maybe I'm misreading. Okay. It says here, I do defy him and spit at him. Ah, there's a good reply. Call him a slanderous coward and a villain, which to maintain I wouldn't allow him all odds, and meet him where I tried to run afoot, even to the frozen ridges of the Alps, or on any other ground inhabitable, where ever Englishman durst set his foot. Meanwhile, let him defend his loyalty. By all my hopes, most falsely does he lie. And then gauntlets are thrown to the ground, people are called names, people are separated, people are getting back together, there's like the pushing and shoving, like a bad junior high moment, like nobody really wants to fight, but they're pretending like they do, and everyone's chest is out like this, and there's lots of bumping going on. Okay, and so the king finally enters in and says, whoa, 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 whoa! And by the way, he says, whoa, 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 but he means, yes, 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 yes. Because he doesn't like either of them. And this isn't a bad thing. This is kind of a win-win for him. One guy kills the other. Okay, I can live with that. That's okay. So, but they are, he says, are you guys sure that you want to do this? And then they call for something that makes the king's blood run cold. They call for a trial by combat. And this trial by combat is an act by which they will fight to the death. And what's so important about this is that everyone believes that the truth of the matter will be proven by God. So whoever wins this trial by combat will be the person that has told the truth. And the person that dies will be proven to be the liar. Now, here's the problem, though. Somewhere back in the king's mind, he probably has this memory. Oh, yeah, right. I sent those guys out. I mean, I didn't send them. I just made a casual suggestion that, boy, it would be nice if Gloucester were out of the way. And because they never even see that in the play. But that's the assumption that everybody makes, all the historians. Everyone's very clear that the king's hand is dirty in this situation. And so he becomes afraid because if Mowbray loses, he's dead. He has nothing more to worry about. But the king, on the other hand, has a lot to worry about. And not only that, this will elevate Bolingbroke into a national legend. He was so confident of his position that he was willing to put his life on the line because he, this man here, he is a follower of God. And we know because God has smiled upon him and proven his claim is right, which puts the king in a very bad light. Again, the king's life has not been exactly all roses up to this point. He's had to fight off a bunch of different attempts to usurp the throne. He's had to fight off a peasant's rebellion. And now we have this other political moment of intrigue here. And so he does not know what to do. And one of the things that you have to realize that Shakespeare really is going to get you to wrestle with is that kings are two beings. There's Richard the man and Richard the king. And they're always in tension with each other. As a matter of fact, every king is fighting off these tensions in the history plays. Every king. So part of the question is, what does it mean to be a king? Is a king a mere man? Or is the king, who has been granted his place by God, more than human? And how do you arbitrate this? Because if he is divinely appointed by God, shouldn't his decisions be right and just at all times? And yet, he makes these errors. So everyone's always wrestling with his position. As a matter of fact, his position is tied to the fact that they believe that since God put him in place, how do you get rid of him? Well, that may be some arguments, right? God puts you in place. Well, but it's the problem is, think about all the way back to the Old Testament, and what does, when David is anointed king of Israel, he doesn't run out and take the throne that day, does he? As a matter of fact, he refuses to do so until Saul is dead. And as a matter of fact, when the messenger comes in and tells him what happens and says, by the way, I was a part of that whole thing, what does David do? He says, you do not touch the Lord's anointed. And he kills him. So here we have this political tension, we have this theological tension, and we just have the tension of what does it mean to be human and have to navigate these very tricky waters politically. So they are always fighting with all of these issues. So here we have Richard in the center of this. And the funniest thing is that you probably won't like Richard for the whole play. But the problem is, what do you do with the fact that he's your king? And there's never, by the way, there's never overt finger pointing going on. So it's like, we think the king is involved with the killing of Gloucester, and we think that Mowbray's involved with it, but it's not even clear why Bolingbroke wants to call him to account for this. Because is Bolingbroke this great virtuous man who's really concerned about the death of his uncle? Because prior to this, he had been a part of an attempt to overthrow the throne too. And so you try to, it's kind of funny in the English history, you try to overthrow the throne, but your family, so you get forgiven for it. You know, I don't know if they, like, sort of punch you in the arm. You crazy guy. Now, knock that sort of usurping off. No more regicide for you. Come on. You should know better. And so they get pardoned. But it's this weird thing. It's like, supposedly, pardoned is forgiven, right? No, it's just, I want you really close so I can watch you, but I shouldn't kill you because there's too many people that you're allied with that can cause me trouble. I'd really like to kill you, but it just wouldn't be very helpful for me right now. So you can live for a while until I figure out a way that you can fall down the stairs multiple times like your uncle did, right? And so here's what happens. There's this sense that everyone has a hand in the cookie jar, politically. So they go to fight. And this is really a loser for Richard, because it's not even clear that Richard, whether or not Richard believes in trial by combat, that's not even talked about. It doesn't matter whether Richard believes it or not. Do you know why? Because everyone else does. So he actually ends up calling them off. It's just this huge thing. So much of Richard is pomp and circumstance, and this sort of regal bearing, and this sort of interesting ways in which they talk about things. They're very formal. And so, after all this pomp and circumstance, I mean, it's like, it's weird. A trial by combat turns into, like, trial by combat the party, right? I mean, they've got huge banners, they've got tents, it's like a party. There are people trumpeting, there, you know, everybody's watching because it's the big event of the summer season, right? Let's all go watch the trial by combat, then we'll go get some pizza, and then we'll go home. Right? I mean, it's sort of like that. So after all this pomp and circumstance, which happens again, this is very quick. This just happens very fast in the play. By Act 1, Scene 3, we are at trial by combat. And the king stops them right before. And this is what he says to them. You guys go wait over there. I'm going to talk with my counselors. And they make them wait and wait and wait. And then they come back, and this is what the king says. He says, draw near and list what with our counsels we have done, for that our kingdom's earth should not be soiled with that dear blood which it had fostered, and for our eyes do hate the dire aspect, our civil wounds plowed up with the neighbor's sword. And for we think the eagle-winged pride, so he's talking to them, you guys are prideful. You need to not do this. You're going to cause chaos. You are going to wake our peace. Again, the question is, really? Aren't the Scots and the Irish people causing problems still? We draw the sweet infant breath of gentle sleep, which so roused that the boisterous untuned drums, with harsh resoundings, trumpets, and dreadful bray, and grating shock of wrathful iron arms, might from our quiet confines fight fair peace, and make us wade even into our kindred's blood. Therefore, in other words, he says, look, I'm not going to let you guys kill each other and draw blood. This is all bad. You're both my kin. I love you, you knuckleheads. Therefore, we banish you of our territories. You, Cousin Hereford, that's Mowbray, upon pain of life. All right, so not Cousin Hereford, that's Bolingbroke. On pain of life, till twice 5 summers have enriched our fields, shall not regret our fair dominions, but tread the stranger path of banishment. So he sends Bolingbroke off. He actually banishes Mowbray for the rest of his life. And he thinks, wow, even better, because I have dealt with both of them, and now they're out of my hair. What happens is everybody's mad, because nobody's happy with how it ended. He has not satisfied anyone. But it gets better. Richard makes one mistake after another. What he does is his friend and loyal confidant, John of Gaunt, dies, and he's the father of Bolingbroke. And while he dies, or when he dies, Bolingbroke is still banished. And so what Richard does through political and legal maneuvering is actually get all of Gaunt's land, which are huge, given to the throne. This forces Bolingbroke's hand. He has no other option but to figure out, to come back and get what's rightfully his back. As a matter of fact, what happens? Think about the nature of this. So you take the land from someone who's been loyal to you. What do you think the rest of the aristocracy is thinking? If you can do it to him, could you do it to the rest of us? Would you be willing to do it to the rest of us? And he even exacerbates it because history tells us that he uses the money. He says ostensibly that he's going to do it because I have to go fight these campaigns to get the Irish. You know, they're hard to control. I've got to use the money. I've got to go spend it for the good of England. But what happens is he spends it on luxurious living. And everybody notices, like, the coaches get more gilding, you know, there's more gold paneling everywhere. The china gets nicer, I don't know, but there are just, everyone becomes very aware of the fact that they are living this ostentatious life. So how bad does it have to be? Because the king, I assume, lives an ostentatious life, right? Sort of over the top, everything's gilded. When you put gilding on top of gilding, right? I mean, everybody starts to know that's how bad it gets, is that everybody's saying, man, he's living high on the hog, and he's the king, and we're noticing. Right? That's how bad it's gotten. And so there are these maneuvers. Everybody's wondering if they're going to be next, if the king can't control himself, if he lives this sort of high-on-the-hog-like life. So right away, you get this painting of Richard that's not very favorable. So we're only three scenes in. And to top it off, he decides to go to Ireland to fight the Irish. But of course, that leaves the back door open for Bolingbroke to come back. And so Bolingbroke comes back, and like any good political intrigue, and the text is so rich that I'm not going to talk about it here, but the text is so rich that all the intrigue that's going on back and forth, where everybody's trying to figure out which side they should go on, because someone has to choose. You can't be neutral. Right? This is going to end, and you better have picked. Because neutral means you lose on both sides. So everyone sort of trying to figure out who they should go with, who they should side with. Bolingbroke hits the ground, supposedly, to come back and get his land. But somewhere about 5 days in, and I'm exaggerating, but not very long, he thinks, you know what? Since I'm here anyway with an army, why don't I just take the kingdom? I mean, I'm here, I've got an army, they're not really doing much. People are starting to flock to his side because he just sort of walks through. Because remember, at the time, you don't have standing armies. You have to gather them up. So the first one that has the army gathered up and is moving in to the land is the one who has a serious tactical advantage. Remember also that the king, with his army, is in Ireland. A bad tactical move also. Clearly, the king does not play chess, or Stratego, or Risk, right? Or anything like that, or what? Age of Empires, or whatever version they were playing back then. Probably that's the problem. He would have been a better king if there was online gaming, probably. So, okay. So what happens is he's in Ireland. His council says, no, no, stay here for a while. Let your friends on the mainland, on the main island, on England, handle it. Then you come in, and then we'll deal with him. Well, by the time Richard gets to the land, gets to England, his men are exhausted. So he thinks that he's going to go with one of his supposedly loyal royalist groups. But they can't find him. They think he must be captured. The rumor goes through that he's been killed. Everybody runs away. So the king shows up at this castle going, "All right, let's go, because there's like 100 men with me. And Bolingbroke is coming." And clearly, there's a problem. Again, think about a chessboard. This is a bad moment. You got like a pawn. And they've got like everything else. And as a matter of fact, they've changed two of their pawns into queens. Right? So you're in trouble. This is not a winning situation. I'm all freaked out that my order is bad, so I'm going to go with the book. So when Richard realizes that he is in big trouble, this is what he says. "What must the king do now? Must he submit? The king shall do it. Must he be deposed? The king shall be contented. Must he lose the name of the king? A God's name, let it go. I'll give my jewels for a set of beads, my gorgeous palace for hermitage, my gay apparel for an almsman gown, my figured goblets for a dish of wood, my scepter for a palmer's walking staff, my subjects for a pair of carved saints, and my large kingdom for a little grave, a little grave, a little grave, an obscure grave, or I'll be buried in the king's highway, some way of common trade where subjects' feet may hourly trample on their sovereign's head. For on my heart they tread now whilst I live." Listen to the way his countenance has changed. He's the king. And yet, look how quickly he surrenders his position. It's just interesting to notice the way in which he carries himself, the things that he says. There are some points when you're reading, you want to yell out, "No, suck it up! Aren't you the king? What's your problem?" Where is the regal carriage? Where is the anger? Even if you've lost, where is the righteous indignation? He doesn't even want the name of king. That's a God's name. No, it's his. So part of the question that you have to wrestle with is, why in the world does he do this? And is this okay? Given the situation, how do you handle this? How do you understand? Even if you think it's wrong, what's the way that he should act? And Shakespeare does not help you. He lets you experience the situation, and then he forces you to think about it. And here we have the major problem. What do you do with a bad king? And when Henry finally comes, or just before he comes, there's a prophecy given by Carlyle about what's going to be happening with Henry's reign, or Bolingbroke, soon to be Henry IV. He says this, "My Lord Hereford here," which would be Bolingbroke, "who you call king, is a foul traitor, too proud Hereford's king. And if you crown him, let me prophesy, the blood of English shall manure the ground. And future ages groan for this foul act. Peace shall go sleep with the Turks and infidels. And in this seat of peace, tumultuous wars shall kin with kin and kind with kind confound. Disorder, honor, fear, and mutiny shall here inhabit. And this land shall be called the field of Golgotha and dead men's skulls. Oh, if you raise this house against this house, it will the woefulest division prove that ever fell upon this cursed earth. Prevent it, resist it, let it not be so. Lest child and child's children cry against you woe. He is saying, you are doing something unnatural. You are in a position to usurp the throne. If you let yourself go through with this, you are damning England. What are you thinking? And I say that it's prophetic because England falls into a tumult that goes on and on and on after this. There are short moments of peace and then right back into chaos. Bolingbroke can't control. You'll see this all in Henry IV. So there's this issue that you are actually, by your actions, causing a crisis in the kingdom. Even though Richard may be bad, notice he doesn't even say, oh no, Richard's a great king. He doesn't say that. He says, what you're doing is wrong. Shortly after that, Bolingbroke in triumph comes in and sees Richard. And it's a pretty amazing scene. Because Richard knows that he is no longer the regent. And he says this. Alack, why am I sent for to a king? Before I have shook off the regal thoughts wherein I reigned, I hardly yet have learned to insinuate, flatter, bow, or bend my limbs. Give sorrow leave a while to tutor me to this submission. Yet I well remember the favors of these men. And he's talking to everyone around him. Were they not mine? Did they not sometimes cry, all hail to me? So Judas did to Christ. But he in 12 found truth in all but one. I in 12,000 none. God save the king. Will no man say amen? Am I both priest and clerk? Well then, amen. God save the king, and although I be not he, and yet, amen. If heaven do think him me. And then he turns to Bolingbroke and says, to do what service am I sent for hither? So they know, they want him to give up the crown. They don't want to take it from him. They want him to capitulate, because that puts him in a better situation. And so the Duke of York says, I want you to resign your state and crown to Henry Bolingbroke. But Richard says, fine, give me the crown. Here, cousin, seize the crown. And he holds it out in front of him. Because he knows what's going on. It's interesting. You get two people. You get the one who's very quick to quit. We just read that a little bit. Now we have this guy who's playing this political game again, isn't he? Like, fine, come and get the crown. You can have it. Come and get it. It's not the same as him resigning, is it? It's radically different. It doesn't look radically different, but it's radically different. On this side my hand, and on that side yours. Now my golden crown, like a well deep, that owes two buckets filling one another. The emptier, ever dancing in the air. The other down, and unseed, and full of water. That bucket down, and full of tears am I. Because he sets the crown on the ground, and it looks like a bucket. He doesn't give it to him, and he doesn't resign. He just sets it down. And then Bolingbroke said, I thought you were willing to resign. He says, my crown I am, but my griefs are still mine. You may my glories and my state depose, but not my griefs. Still I am king of those. Part of your care, says Bolingbroke, you give me with your crown. And Richard says, your care is set up. Do not pluck my cares down. My care is loss of care, by old care done. Your care is gain of care, by new care won. The cares I give, I have, though given away. They tend the crown, yet still with me they stay. And he still says, are you contented in resigning the crown? And then he goes on and he says, I know no and I, for I must nothing be. Therefore no, for I resign to thee. But mark me, how I will undo myself. I give this heavy weight from off my head, and this unwieldy scepter from my hand, the pride of kingly sway from out my heart. With mine own tears I wash away my balm. With mine own hands I give away my crown. With mine own tongue deny my sacred state. With mine own breath release all duty rights. All pomp and majesty do I forswear. My manners, rents, revenues I forego. My acts, decrees, and statutes deny. God pardon all oaths that are broken to me. God keep all vows that are unbroken that swear to thee. So here again, we have a refusal to actually say the thing that needs to be said in legal terms. And what happens is that Henry comes to realize, now Henry, right? He's now Henry IV. He comes to realize that this is a problem. And he says this, have I no friend who will rid me of this living fear? And he says this sort of, he doesn't say it to anyone, he just says, this thing is a problem. Have I no friend that will deal with this issue? What can I do? Does someone have a plan? Notice the obscure nature of this. But a sort of minor player in the aristocracy hears this and thinks, ah, opportunity. His name is Exton. They leave the room. He looks at his servant and says this. Dost thou not mark the king what words he spake? Have I no friend who will read me of this living fear? Was it not so? Did he not say that? And the servant says, those were his very words. Exton goes, have I no friend? Quoth he. He spake it twice. And urged it twice together. Did he not? He did, said the servant. And speaking it, he wistfully looked on me. And who should say, I would that thou were the man. He made those kingly goo-goo eyes at me, and I knew what he wanted, and I knew he couldn't say it, but he was winking. That would divorce this terror from my heart. meeting the king at Pomfret. Come, let us go. I am the king's friend and will rid his foe. And so, Exton goes, kills the king. The dialogue between Exton and the king Richard II is pretty amazing. But Exton, at the end of the play, comes back with a coffin. And he says this, "Great king, within this coffin I present thy buried fear. Herein, all breathless lies thy mightiest of thy greatest enemies, Richard of Bordeaux, by me hither brought." And Bolingbroke says, "Exton, I thank thee not, for thou hast wrought a deed of slander with thy fatal hand upon my head and all this famous land." And Exton says, "From your own mouth, my lord, did I this deed." But here, notice, at the beginning of the play, we have a murder. At the end of the play, we have a murder. And a huge lack of clarity about why and how it happened. Imagine if you're the barrister trying this case, and you are Henry IV. What are you going to say? I was just saying, man, this is a pain. What am I going to do with this? I didn't mean go kill him. And Exton is going to say, "You did that kingly looky wink thing at me. That's what you did." He's going to say, "I don't know what you think. I had something in my eye. It was a new, regal robe, and it's got that fuzz on it, and that's always flipping off all the time. So I got it in my eye, I was like rubbing it away, and you thought I was giving you that come hither, go kill look." And all of a sudden off you went. And you did me a disservice. So at the end, no one knows, and by the way, Shakespeare does not help you. He leaves you in this state of confusion. Wondering what was going to happen. And Bolingbroke says this at the end of the play. Now Henry IV. "They love not poison that do poison need, nor do I thee, though I did wish him dead. I hate the murderer, loved him murdered. The guilt of conscience takes thou for thy labor, but neither my good word nor princely favor. With Cade go wander through shades of night, and never show thy head by day nor light. Lords, I protest, my soul is full of woe, that blood should sprinkle me to make me grow. Come, mourn with me, for that I do lament, and put on sullen black in content." And then he makes this vow. "I'll make a voyage to the Holy Land to wash this blood off from my guilty hand. March sadly after, grace my mourning here, in weeping after this untimely bier." So here, this is where the play ends. So not pomp and circumstance, not like coronation, not like everything's back together. Wow, England's back on the right path because Richard the Loser is gone. Henry IV, the impressive, right, is here. There are coronations, there are newspapers, there's Twittering, there's all kinds of things going on. People are Facebooking. I mean, it's a crazy place. No, none of that does it. It doesn't end like that at all. As a matter of fact, there is something that happens even before this that is really interesting. And it almost seems like an aside. Bolingbroke has landed. He's taking over the kingdom. A pretty momentous occasion. And he says this in Act 5, Scene 3, after the king has, Richard has given up the throne. He asks about someone you'll become much more familiar with. He asks about his son, Hal. And this is how he's described. Can no man tell me of my unthrifty son? So he's looking for his son, who you assume would be at his side, because this is sort of a momentous occasion where we're taking over, and you should be sort of with the family business, right? And he's not there. He says this, 'Tis a full 3 months since I did see him last. Okay. If any plague hang over us, 'tis he. I would to God, my lords, he might be found. Inquire at London, amongst the taverns there. Note, he does not say, he's probably at church praying, it's evensong right now, and so he'll probably be there, you know, probably talking with the priests afterwards, because that's kind of how he is, and sort of doing theological discussions. No, he's at a bar. Check all the bars in London, because that's probably where he is. For there, they say, he doth frequent, with unrestrained loose companions, even such, they say, as stand in narrow lanes, and beat our watch and rob our passengers. Which he, young wanton and effeminate boy, take on the point of honor to support so dissolute a crew. So he is the honorable man who's leading this... Oh, ruffians is what they are. And he's not really that noble anyway. He's effeminate. And this is now the man who's prince. This does not bode well for England, does it? Does this actually say something about his father? As well as the son. How are we to come to understand the nature of this usurpation if these are the people that are to lead this mighty nation, this nation supposedly committed to following God, going on crusades? How are we to think of this? How are we to come to understand? Because Henry IV, two plays, parts 1 and 2, where Hal will be a central figure. And he becomes probably the most well-known king in all of England. Maybe next to Arthur, when he becomes Henry V. How do you become, how do you go from the thing just described, and will even be described worse later, to this great king? Or a supposed great king. And especially with this prophecy hanging over your head. How do you come to understand the rightness and wrongness of these acts? When nothing is that clear. And that is the brilliance of Shakespeare. It's going to not give you the answer. It's going to force you to wrestle with the concepts. It's going to force you to understand what it means to lead, to arbitrate decisions, to choose between two seemingly horrible options. To pick Richard, who's a mess, or to pick Henry, who's got a son that's a mess. That's the issue at hand. So as you enter into these discussions, as you're thinking about these kings Try to put yourself in their place. How do you make these decisions? How do you arbitrate? Are there clues? How would you, in these situations, lead? That's the thing that you have to wrestle with. And really, you have to ask yourself, when does a king stop being a king? Okay, questions. We have like, what, 5 minutes? 3 minutes?
Can you expand on your last question?
Can I expand on it?
Why?
How is a king? What do you mean?
I guess, what do you mean?
Okay, what part of it was it?
What
part aren't you sure about? I mean... Okay, well, send me my question again.
I just want the answer.
When does the king stop becoming the king?
Yeah, okay, so I'm asking you, when is he no longer, when can you take him off the throne?
Okay.
When are you allowed to do that? Is there ever a time that you're allowed to do that?
So when are you justified?
Yeah.